follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
U.S. Democrats are attempting to enact a social policy bill using a fast-track procedural rule known as reconciliation to shield it from the Senate filibuster, which requires 60 votes to pass most legislation. I prepared for you an article written by Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled U.S. Democrats Search for a Path Forward as Key Deadlines Loom. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Fate of U.S. President Joe Biden's domestic agenda underlined, Democrats search furiously for a path forward after negotiations over a once-in-a-generation expansion of the social safety net neared collapse, and a vote on a smaller public works measure appeared increasingly unlikely. With almost no margin for error and little time left to break an impasse that threatens to imperil its passage and possibly the entirety of President Biden's program, Democrats charged ahead on Thursday, 30th of September, even as a crucial Democratic holdout called for the shrinking the $3.5 trillion plan in half. But assurances of progress offered little comfort to nervous Democrats on Capitol Hill, where a series of legislative and fiscal deadlines loom. As Biden spent the day locked in negotiations with Democratic leadership and lawmakers, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters on Wednesday, 29th of September, we're obviously at a precarious and important time in these discussions. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, insisted on Thursday morning, 30th of September, that she was prepared to move ahead with a vote later on in the day. She said, at an unusually crowded press conference, "So far, so good for today. It's going in a positive direction. We're on a path to win the vote." The cautiously optimistic tone reflected the fluid nature of the negotiations after Nancy Pelosi previously left open the possibility that she could delay a Thursday vote on the infrastructure bill, while President Biden worked to secure an agreement with two centrist holdouts on his broader social policy package that aims to fulfill Democrats' promise to reshape the American economy. U.S. Congress did meet one critical deadline after the House and Senate approved a short-term funding bill that averted a government shutdown at midnight by funding federal agencies through to 3rd of December. At the center of the uncertainty are centrist Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. Both have said that the price tag on President Biden's agenda is too high, but to the immense frustration of their colleagues, have not publicly outlined what they would be comfortable with spending. Compromise is the only way forward for Democrats, who need every vote in the Senate and nearly every vote in the House. In a statement on Wednesday, 29th of September, Senator Joe Manchin reiterated his opposition to the current spending package, saying it amounted to fiscal insanity. Then, speaking to reporters on Thursday, 30th of September, he said he would not support a package that costs more than $1.5 trillion, less than half the size of the package that President Biden and Democrats are seeking, warning that any more spending risks changing our whole society to an entitlement mentality. He said the president was aware of his red line. The scaled-down offer would likely be a non-starter with progressives, who say they have already made significant concessions. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, a progressive from Minnesota, said in an appearance on MSNBC, "What do they want us to cut? Childcare for families that desperately need it? Do they want to not address the climate crisis for a future generation? Do they not want home care programs for our seniors and the disabled? These are the conversations we're waiting to have." Senator Joe Manchin's position makes it unlikely that Democrats will reach a deal by coming days, when Nancy Pelosi wants the House to vote on the Senate-passed infrastructure bill, which would spend billions of dollars upgrading the nation's roads, bridges, and broadband. Asked by reporters if he was confident the vote would happen on Thursday, 7th of October, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer replied, "No." That leaves Democratic leaders in a time-sensitive bind, partially of their own making. They initially promised progressives that they would advance the infrastructure and social policy bills in tandem. At the same time, Nancy Pelosi told centrists that she would bring a vote on the infrastructure bill to the floor of the House this week. But with Senator Joe Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema objecting to the cost of the social spending proposal, Nancy Pelosi said she was forced to shift strategy. Now she's asking her caucus to move ahead with the infrastructure bill, while President Biden and the senators search for a compromise. Social policy bill could be transformative for millions of American families, though the details are fluid and the overall package almost certain to shrink. The proposed legislation would extend the child tax credit, establish universal pre-K education, create a federally paid family and medical leave system, in addition to an array of programs to combat the climate crisis and transition the country towards renewable energy. The plan would be paid for by trillions of dollars in tax increases under wealthiest Americans and wealthiest corporations. U.S. Democrats are attempting to enact a social policy bill using a fast-track procedural rule known as reconciliation to shield it from the Senate filibuster, which requires 60 votes to pass most legislation. The move to decouple the groundbreaking legislation from Thursday's infrastructure bill vote has infuriated progressives, who say they will sink the infrastructure vote if there is not an agreement on the broader package. In a sign of the deep mistrust within the Democratic Party, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said she wanted to see the Senate approve the package first before supporting the smaller bill. Complicating matters further, Senator Kyrsten Sinema is saying she wants to see the infrastructure bill passed without delay, even as her objections to the larger bill risk delaying or completely derailing its passage. Nancy Pelosi said there would need to be an agreement with President Biden on the legislative language for his social policy bill before the vote on Thursday, 7th of October. She added at the press conference, "I just told members of my leadership that the reconciliation bill was a culmination of my service in Congress. Remove all doubt in anyone's mind that we will not have a reconciliation. We will have a reconciliation bill, that is for sure. As Democrats worked to salvage their ambitious plan, lawmakers made little progress towards resolving the stalemate over the debt ceiling. In a largely party-line vote on Wednesday night, 29th of September, the House approved legislation that would suspend the debt limit through to 16th of December. That bill advances to a vote in the Senate, where the path to overcoming Republican obstruction remains unclear. The brinkmanship has pushed the country dangerously close to financial calamity, and yet both sides appear dug in. Republicans want to force Democrats to raise the debt ceiling on their own by using the reconciliation process to circumvent the Senate filibuster. Senator Schumer called the position hypocritical, arguing that Republicans have a responsibility to help raise the debt limit, as Democrats did on three occasions during the Trump administration. Senator Schumer said, "As default gets closer and closer to becoming a reality, our Republican colleagues will be forced to ask themselves how long they're going to keep playing political games while the economic stability of our country is at risk." But on Thursday, 30th of September, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell insisted that Democrats have plenty of time to raise the debt ceiling without Republican votes by using a budget reconciliation procedure. Senator Mitch McConnell said, This may be inconvenient for them, but it is totally possible. This Democratic government must not manufacture an avoidable crisis. Even if those urgent problems are resolved, the question over President Biden's agenda remains, with the White House and Democratic leaders racing against the clock to strike a deal. With little room for error, President Biden continued his personal outreach to reluctant Democrats, as some members doubled down publicly in television interviews and on Twitter. Even if a consensus is reached, the laborious task of trimming and finalizing the bills remains. Asked whether Democrats could pull it off, White House spokesperson Jen Psaki told reporters to stay tuned. She said, "Of the high-stakes negotiations, it is like an episode of a television show. But which show depends on what happens next." She said, "Maybe the West Wing if something good happens, maybe Veep if not." In the uniform of a soldier. Part 4.
November the 16th, 1980. All coordination was done for the operation to defeat the siege of Susangir. Everything was ready. Bani Sadr had promised that the 2nd Brigade would enter the operation from the 92 Khuzestan Division. But a feeling told Ayatollah Khamenei that this promise might not be fulfilled. That evening, in a telephone conversation with Ayatollah Ishraqi, the Imam's son-in-law, Ayatollah Khamenei conveyed his concern. Mr. Ishraqi raised this concern with the Imam. However, Ayatollah Khamenei, who saw the readiness of the forces on the night of the operation to break the siege of Susangir on November 16, 1980, decided not to mention what the Imam had said so that things could proceed as planned previously. At the headquarters of the operation, all the Army, IRGC, and popular forces were ready to start the operation. But suddenly, it was reported that the 2nd Brigade of the 92nd Division of Khuzestan was barred from entering the operation. The news was shocking. Without the presence of the other two brigades, the operation would make no sense. Colonel Qasemi, commander of the Khuzestan Division, said the order came from above. It seems that President Banisadr ordered the commander of the ground forces not to operate the 92nd Division. Time is short. Ayatollah Khamenei takes the initiative. But this was not enough. Ayatollah Khamenei must also directly involve the highest military official in the operation. Under both letters, Dr. Chamran adds his complaints about the inconsistencies. These letters change the fate of Operation Susangird. Years later, Colonel Qasemi, the commander of the 92nd Armored Division in Ahvaz, to whom Ayatollah Khamenei had written his first letter that night, visited Ayatollah Khamenei. During this meeting, Colonel Qasemi had brought a historical document with him. "I do not consider this deviation from the decision made this afternoon to be justifiable. This means shutting down or failing tomorrow's operation. The strength of the enemy is such that the two infantry companies are not able to stand against it, and if the brigade does not act, then the operation is not complete. In the morning, if we want to finally wait for the arrival of Commander Zahir Nejat to make a decision, time will pass. Our youth in Susangir will resist until the morning at most, and early in the morning, if we do not lighten the burden of the enemy a little, all will be destroyed and the city will fall completely. In short, in our opinion, the plans must proceed in the same manner as decided in the evening, and the brigade should be ready to act in the morning. Otherwise, the responsibility for the fall of Susangird lies on anyone who has deviated from this decision. The 2nd Brigade of the 92 Khuzestan Division joined the operation, and early in the morning the attack takes place. The warriors are invigorated by seeing the representative of the Imam among themselves. Ayatollah Khamenei also visited the armies of the 2nd Brigade of the 92 Khuzestan Division to thank them. The Iranian forces advanced as far as Susangird Road, where they drove out the Ba'athists. Finally, by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Imam's order was carried out. The siege of Susangird was broken, and the enemy's threat was lifted from Ahvaz. 3 days later, on November the 20th, Ayatollah Khamenei, given the experience of this successful operation, said in a meeting of the Supreme Council of Defense, "The liberation of Susangird was carried out in a few hours. This meant that the Iranians can force back the enemy. The problem, however, was sabotage." The winter of 1980 began with the launch of another operation. The army had launched a large-scale operation to force back the enemy from Hoveze. Operation Nasr 1 went well on the first day. News of the capture of hundreds of enemy prisoners was heard. That same day, Ayatollah Khamenei saw a familiar face. But the next day, January the 7th, the tides turned. The enemy had carried out a heavy offensive. Our ammunition, equipment, and air support were not enough to deal with such an offensive. The troops withdrew that afternoon. It was also reported from the plains of Hoveze that Alam al-Huda and his companions were left stranded in the face of the enemy tanks, unsupported. They had resisted to the last bullet. Many of those men were martyred. During the recession that prevailed on the fronts after the bitter defeat of Hoveze, Ayatollah Khamenei went to a new front. He went abroad to the media war front. February 11th, 1981, Ayatollah Khamenei traveled to India. He presented the stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the war with Muslims of other countries. His speech had a great impact on Muslims. The positions of revolutionary Iran were enthusiastically heard and welcomed. On February the 17th, the Muslim leaders of the Indian League the largest Muslim political party in the Indian subcontinent at the time, visited Ayatollah Khamenei and condemned Saddam's aggression, which was a major victory for Iran in terms of public diplomacy. With this international experience, Ayatollah Khamenei came back to Iran to return to the matters regarding the war. But with his arrival in Iran, the international issues of the war did not end. In March, a delegation from the Organization of the Islamic Conference arrived in Iran to hold peace talks between Iran and the Ba'athist Iraqi regime. While the country needed unity in talks with foreign parties, the country's internal atmosphere became tense again. On March the 5th, Bani Sadr gave a speech at the University of Tehran on the anniversary of Mossadegh's death. The MKO fully supported the president in this ceremony, adding to the controversy. The president said things that made people pessimistic about the political situation. He blamed the IRGC and the prime minister and pretended to be the victim of a conspiracy. The next day, March the 6th, 1981, in the same place, Ayatollah Khamenei, in order to maintain unity and prevent divisions, remained silent about the role of the president in the unpleasant events of yesterday and instead, the official position of the Islamic Republic towards the foreign mediation delegation was announced. In general, Ayatollah Khamenei tried not to highlight the role of Bani Sadr in the unfortunate events of the country by the order of the Imam, but the problems that Bani Sadr created continued. In the same days, Bani Sadr fired a young army officer named Ali Sayyad Shirazi. He was the commander of the operational base in the west of the country. Bani Sadr dismissed him for opposing Sayyad Shirazi's policy in the fight against the anti-revolutionaries in Kurdistan. In the same days, Ayatollah Khamenei met a young man at the Ahvaz Gulf barracks who had set up an IRGC reconnaissance unit. Prior to that, reconnaissance was inadequate and very scattered. But Hassan Bagdadi, a journalist with the Jomhuri Islami newspaper, was able to set up an IRGC reconnaissance unit and obtain valuable information from within the enemy lines for the IRGC and the army to use. In the poisonous atmosphere of the politics of the time, these moments were a beacon of hope for the battlefields. This was the beginning of a belief in the faithful revolutionary youths in the heart of a time when the then president did not believe in them. Young people who could change the fate of the war. The year 1981 began when Ayatollah Khamenei decided to go to the western front of the country. Initially, Ayatollah Khamenei flew by helicopter to the border heights of Kermanshah and closely examined the enemy positions in the west of the country. Ayatollah Khamenei went to Abu Zar Garrison. After the speech, Ayatollah Khamenei also answered the questions of the Iranian forces. The next day, continuing to the southern areas of the Western Front, they reached the plain of Abbas. The meadow was full of red poppies. On April the 1st, Ayatollah Khamenei went to Kurdistan and Pave. The people of the city showed Ayatollah Khamenei the location of the Battle of Pave on August 16, 1979, where Chamron and a few of the city's defenders had resisted the counter-revolution. On April the 19th, Ayatollah Khamenei also met with the Qalqani nomads, who lived in their beautiful black tents, the nomads defending the borders with their Bernal rifles and their forces defending themselves against the enemy. In Mariwan, the commander of the city corps came to meet Ayatollah Khamenei, a young and energetic young man named Ahmad Motavassilyan. Ayatollah Khamenei went to Desli with the intercessors. Motavassilyan explains to Ayatollah Khamenei that he he and his men had liberated the Desli border region from counter-revolutionary occupation. In May 1981, Ayatollah Khamenei frequently visited the southern front, especially the most dangerous part of it, Abadan, which was under siege. The only way to reach Abadan was by air. The locals did not leave their hometown even in the worst condition. Ayatollah Khamenei flew by helicopter from Mahshahrport to Abadan, landing in a village near Abadan on the west coast of Bahmanshir. Ayatollah Khamenei spoke to the armies and troops of Abadan to boost their morale. At this time, Ayatollah Khamenei met the forces of Sayyid Mojtaba Hashemi. To cross the city center, they had to pass through the middle of houses. From this route, Ayatollah Khamenei went to Kut Sheikh, the last area of Khorramshahr that had not yet been occupied. On June 10th, the morning ceremony for 40 days since the passing of martyr Shirudi, Ayatollah Khamenei left for Tonekabun to deliver a speech at the memorial service for this martyr. At midnight, the radio broadcast crucial news about the war. The news, however, did not come from the fronts, but from Tehran. Upon hearing it, Ayatollah Khamenei immediately headed back to the capital. The commanders of the army were worried. The Imam assured them that the removal of Bani Sadr would not change the mission of the army. Then Imam Khomeini got up to go to Jamaran Hosseiniyeh to meet with the people. The last slogan was the hope of the army under the command of the Imam himself in these difficult days. Bani Sadr suddenly disappeared after being removed. The meeting of the Supreme Defense Council was held on June the 20th without Bani Sadr, but one of the members who was usually absent was present this time. None of the council members knew that this was the last time they would see Dr. Chamran. On the same day, Chamran was leaving for the front, and Ayatollah Khamenei was leaving for another front. June the 20th, 1981, the president's political incompetence was proposed. On the morning of June the 21st, it was reported from the southern front that Mustafa Chamran had been martyred in Dehlavi. On that day, which was the second day of impeachment and negotiations to examine the inadequacy of Bani Sadr, Ayatollah Khamenei had to speak after months of silence. On that day, members of parliament approved the Bani Sadr inadequacy plan and sent it to Jamaran. On June the 22nd, it was reported that Bani Sadr had been removed from the presidency by the Imam. 5 days later, on June the 27th, Ayatollah Khamenei visited the Imam in Jamaran. When he came out, he saw one of the army pilots named Abbas Babai. Images of martyrs, war, and close friends like martyr Chamran, who had just been martyred, shaped his memories of recent days and months. Who knew? Perhaps those moments and hours were the last of the divine test for Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Hosseini Khamenei. Destiny, however, decided another fate. The Imam issued a message regarding the attempted assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei. I congratulate you, dear Khamenei, who served this oppressed nation on the battlefield in military uniform and behind the front in clerical uniform. And may God bless you for your health. I want Muslims to continue serving Islam. The Imam's message was a sign of acceptance of the service of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei in military uniform. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Biden administration added another repressive measure against migrants on top of Donald Trump's already draconian Title 42. Now Border Patrol agents have the right to decide asylum cases, says Tatiana Cazzarelli, writer in an article titled, Biden is expediting deportations of migrant families. Stay tuned for more. On the campaign trail, Biden promised humane immigration policies, seeking to win votes from all those people horrified by the concentration camps at the border and the draconian immigration policies of Donald Trump. But as president, Biden is a continuation of not a break with Trump. Recently, the Biden administration gave one more example of this. The administration announced that it will remove migrant families without due process. If border officials deem a family unqualified for asylum, they will be deported immediately. Expedited removal provides a lawful, more accelerated procedure to remove those family units who do not have a basis under U.S. law to be in the United States, the Department of Homeland Security said. What this really means is that terrified migrants fleeing persecution, violence, and sexual assault, who are making a long, violent, and terrifying trek to the U.S., will be interrogated by border agents. These migrants are fleeing their home countries because of the imperialist policies that have created violence, instability, and abject poverty. They have survived political persecution, violence, sexual assault, and a long, dangerous trajectory to the border. And when they arrive to the border, asylum cases can and will be decided by the mood, the xenophobia, and the extortion of Border Patrol agents, who are both prosecutor and judge. It means border agents will be in charge of deciding if immigrants have a credible fear of persecution on the spot. Camille Mackler, founder and executive director of Immigrant ARC, said, the expedited removal procedure involves sitting across a desk from a government agent signing a deportation order. There is no ability to see a judge, consult with a legal advocate, much less an attorney, or otherwise understand the process. This is on top of the rule enacted in the Trump era known as Title 42, which allows the United States to immediately send migrants back across the border even if they wish to make an asylum claim. But Title 42 removals aren't enough for Biden. The Department of Homeland Security announced that certain family units who are not able to be expelled under Title 42 will be placed in expedited removal proceedings. Ray says Texas tweeted, "This is new policy is Title 42 on steroids. The expansion of the ability to deport just about anyone who arrives at the southern border, including children." Immigrants' rights activists argue that expedited removal and Title 42 result in longer stays in customs and border protection facilities where migrants experience inhumane and violent conditions. Robin Barnard, senior advocacy counsel at Human Rights First, tweeted, "The whole point of expedited removal is to summarily deport PPW out seeing a judge to make their claim for asylum. DHS locks them up in prisons while they effect these summary deportations, and it all happens in quick succession to make it cheaper for government." Like every Democrat who came before him, Biden uses more humane language to cover up brutal policies against migrants. While there are open borders for capital with free trade agreements that facilitate the exploitation of workers, people are barred entry. This isn't just about one law. Title 42 is based on a 1944 public health statute to close the border to non-essential travel. Trump revived this policy in March 2020. It has been maintained and now expanded under the Biden administration despite protests and lawsuits. As a result, explains the LA Times, U.S. border officials have claimed unchecked unilateral authority to summarily expel from the country hundreds of thousands of immigrants, adults, families, and unaccompanied minors who didn't have prior permission to enter without due process or access to asylum, let alone testing for the coronavirus. In the year of Title 42, less than 1% have been able to seek protection in the U.S., and Title 42 was applied to over 80% of migrants. This included 16,000 unaccompanied minors and 34,000 children expelled alongside their parents. Human rights lawyers and the United Nations say Title 42 is illegal because it's almost impossible to get asylum through this process. Lawyers claim that Biden, like Trump, is breaking international law. The Biden administration's use of Title 42 is flatly illegal, said Lee Glarant of the American Civil Liberties Union, which sued the Trump administration over the policy. The Biden administration is now defending the policy in court. There is zero daylight between the Biden administration and the Trump administration's position, Glarant said. The truth is that Biden's policies aren't fair or humane, and Biden has no solutions for migrants. The expedited removal is actually more draconian than Trump's already brutal policies. It means that even more people will be deported, and it gives the Border Patrol an absurd amount of power. It means an expansion of already brutal laws. Rachel Sheridan, litigation counsel at Tahrir Justice Center, said, "Because of this policy, women seeking protection from domestic violence, sexual violence, human trafficking, and other forms of gender-based harm could be deported without having the chance to prove their case for asylum. There is no fixing the broken system based on militarization and borders. After all, immigration is the result of imperialist policies, and with climate change, people won't stop being displaced. And the criminalization of immigrants is convenient for employers in the U.S. It allows the super exploitation of migrants who are treated as second-class citizens." The Biden administration's immigration policies have continued those of Trump, with kinder and more polite language, like the explanation by Susan Rice. But the brutality continues. The concentration camps on the border are overcrowded and lack basic health supplies. Kids are still in cages, and sexual assaults of children have been reported at facilities that remain open. Migrants are merely fleeing the results of U.S. imperialism, the coups that destabilize countries, the debt that forces austerity of semi-colonial countries, the U.S. corporations and their low wages, the climate change created by the wealthiest people in the world and U.S. corporations. Americans cannot be pacified by Biden's kind imperialism rhetoric. He is maintaining and escalating the brutal policies of Trump and his Democratic and Republican predecessors.
Aperture.
During the Vietnam War, the U.S. military engaged in an aggressive program of chemical warfare codenamed Operation Ranch Hand. Now, from 1961 to 1971, the U.S. military sprayed a range of herbicides across more than 4.5 million acres of Vietnam to destroy the forest cover and food crops used by North Vietnamese. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange, which contains the deadly chemical dioxin, was the most commonly used herbicide. It was later proven to cause serious health issues, including cancer, birth defects, rashes, and severe psychological and neurological problems. But the Vietnamese were not the only ones affected. U.S. soldiers unknowingly brought the legacy of Agent Orange back home. Join us for this week's Aperture as we meet three children of U.S. veterans who fall victim to Agent Orange and follow them as they travel to Vietnam to face their demons. Here's the first part.
All I ever heard was war stories about how horrible it was and how violent everything was, and that there was just death and destruction. And that's the picture that was painted in my head of what Vietnam was. And it scared me half to death when I was getting ready to come over here, to the point where I was actually shaking on the plane on my way here because I did not know what to expect.
Traveling here, someone said, you know, Heather travels back to the land of her father's demons. Vietnam is still a very scary, dangerous place to them.
I was actually very nervous and very scared. Several of my father's friends kind of scared me about some of the things that I may see and hear and experience. Their vision of Vietnam was a war-torn, angry place.
Do you guys have any bottled water before we get going, just in case?
My name is Josh Kelly. I was born on August 18th, 1975.
My name is Heather Bowser. My maiden name is Morris.
My name is Rachel Harding. I was born in northern Indiana near Chicago.
My dad was Daniel Kelly. He was in the U.S. Marine Corps, and he fought in Vietnam.
My parents had married 9 days before he had left for Vietnam. They said that, you know, if they had 9 days being together, that's what they wanted to do.
My father got his draft papers when he turned 18, and chose to marry my mother before he left. They got married, and 2 weeks later, he was deployed to Vietnam.
I've been trying to find out what exactly happened when he was there, because when I was younger, I tried to block the stories out because some of them were so scary and so violent and all that, that I just tried to not even listen to them because I didn't want to hear it because they scared the fuck out of me because I was just a kid.
When they came home, they wanted to put the war behind them. The Vietnam War was a very difficult political time, civil rights time, and so wanting to put it behind them, start their family, and move on.
As soon as he came home, they chose to wait to have children. They waited about 7 years before they decided to try, and I was the firstborn.
String's already broken, and he doesn't really care. It keeps changing fast. It don't last for long. The Colorado Rocky Mountain High.
So my mother had two miscarriages. She lost two children. And no one in our family had had any kind of problems in that respect. So it was very unexpected. And then in 1972, my mother was pregnant again and felt that she had gone into labor early. She was not due for a while. They went to the hospital. She had already lost two children, so she was very scared. She thought she might be miscarrying again at a very late time in the pregnancy. They rushed her into the hospital, and she said, I'm in labor. And she was very thin, and they kind of said, no, you're okay. It's okay. You're going to be all right. You're not in labor. You barely look pregnant. She was 7 months along at that point. My mother woke up to my father sitting at her bedside telling her, and it's hard to talk about, but he said, Sharon, she's damaged. And that's what she woke up to. So I can only imagine how scary that was.
The doctors, as soon as I was born, they took me from my mom, and they put me in a little incubator, and then they rushed me off out of the room. They didn't explain anything to my mom. They just said that there was problems.
Various doctors approached my mother at different times and asked what she had done to her child. What had she done to cause such terrible problems?
They brought her over to show me to her for about 5 minutes, and then they put me on an airplane and they flew me to another state, and they kept me in the incubator. And they put me in intensive care, and they had all kinds of doctors looking at me and checking to see if I was going to live or die or what the deal was, because missing my arms and my legs, they weren't sure what all was wrong with me. They started to take me to the doctors and stuff out there, and because they were big hospitals and there was lots of doctors from around the world and everything, they wanted to try a whole bunch of different surgeries and stuff that were like experimental surgeries that nobody had ever tried before. Like, one of them was that they wanted to grow my arms back, and the way that they were going to do it is they were going to cut the skin open, break the bone, and then they were going to drill holes through it and put screws in it and put plates to separate the bone, and the bone would grow in between the gaps. And they said that it could take up to 5 to 10 years for my arms to finish growing back. and that it would be an extremely painful.
I want to go back to real quick to one memory I had in kindergarten. We were learning about our hands. This is your left hand, this is your right hand. And it's always a memory that I kind of laugh about. I loved school. I couldn't wait to go to school. I was so excited. I wanted to read and do that stuff. So we're sitting in this circle, and the little children are sitting there, and I can just remember this to this day. And there was like a board on the floor, and it had a picture, an outline of a hand and another hand. And each child was to go around and take their turn and say, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, this is my left hand, this is my right hand. And so I remember just being anxious and excited to do my turn. And I went to put my hand in, and I just, at that moment, I was like, oh, okay. Because they had the outline, and my fingers didn't match the outline. And I was like, okay, this is my left hand, this is my right hand, but they don't look like that left hand and that right hand. And that was kind of like, okay, I'm different, that's different.
Pretty much all my life, as far back as I can remember, I knew I was different because I was always going to the doctors, and I would always see the other kids playing and stuff, and I couldn't really go play with them because I either had doctor's appointments or they didn't want anything to do with me. Or
I have lost 19 children. I never carried more longer than 8.5 weeks, and I would lose my children. I have hypothyroidism, the infertility issue, and psoriatic arthritis. Those are the three biggest ones that I have that affect my life personally. And my family could not understand, my father included, could not understand, where did this come from? Nobody else in the family's ever had this. How come you're suffering from this and nobody else ever had?
I've seen lots of different kids that had disabilities and stuff from being like in the hospitals and stuff all the time, and some of them are so similar that it would have to be from the same thing. The similarities in our disabilities are so much alike. There's no way to deny that it was the same thing that caused both of them.
These are the structural formulas for 2,4-dichlorophenoxyacetic acid, commonly known as 2,4-D and 2,4,5-T. From these chemicals are made a large number of closely related compounds, which are sold commercially for weed and brush control. The Secretary of Defense initiated a project to determine whether visibility in troublesome jungle vegetation in the Republic of Vietnam could be improved by aerially applied chemical sprays. In that country, jungle growth, swamp foliage, and roadside vegetation retains its leaves the year around. Consequently, it affords ideal concealment to guerrilla terrorists who sporadically attack the free people of Vietnam. As a result of these tests, defoliation spraying was placed on an operational basis. Those chemicals already proven most effective as defoliants will continue to be used until faster acting types.
So my father says that he said that there was spraying of his base pretty regularly. I found out since that his base was practically sprayed every day, and that is also due to its proximity to Benoit. Benoit was the epicenter of where Ranch Hand worked out of. So if they had anything left on their missions, they came around that area and used it. The perimeter was hand sprayed, aerial spraying with the C-123 plane.
My dad was in the U.S. Marine Corps. He was stationed in the Chu Lai Air Base. And while he was there, he was exposed to lots of Agent Orange. They sprayed it on everything. It was in the food, it was in the water, it was on their clothes, it was on the plants, it was on the guns, the ammo, everything had Agent Orange on it. So he was heavily exposed to Agent Orange.
North Vietnam charged today that defoliants have produced many instances of miscarriages, congenital defects, and monstrosities among children.
As we anticipated, the Vietnamese doctors that we've met with very much share our concerns about the effects of Agent Orange
Although that war was long ago, there is lingering anger about the United States' use of a controversial defoliant spread by American aircraft on the jungles there.
Milton Ross, a special forces advisor near Pleiku, has a son born without the tips of his fingers.
Frank Moore is nearly dead from cancer. He thinks the cancer was caused by chemical defoliant he was exposed to as a soldier in Vietnam.
My dad explained to me about how dangerous the stuff was because it would kill off big old trees and everything in just a couple of days. He would tell me the stories about how he would have to mix it and he would have to load it into the tanks and he would put the tanks on the planes and the helicopters and everything while he was in the war.
It's still causing trouble, and all of the people that have lost their lives to Agent Orange, and this is kind of where it began. So it's very sad.
We found out that the rate of miscarriages, fetal death in utero, and birth defects are 4 times higher than in the exposed. Among the exposed than the non-exposed. We have carried out some more studies. I'm now very sure, certain, that toxic chemicals cause many things to my people, to the exposed people. Cannot deny, the relationship between dioxin with the abnormal outcome of pregnancy. Among the exposed people.
After the war time, I lived after 75, his father's dead, came back here, and they have the first child. But due to the Asian Orange, she or he died after 10 days.
The biggest biggest child of the family is a normal child because he was born before the time that the death came to the army.
But do you know in America who carries the pain of Agent Orange? The veterans. The veterans feel responsible. Our fathers felt responsible. Even for in Vietnam, it means they felt responsible. The soldier, not the chemical companies or the government that made the decision.
So my father felt extreme guilt. He felt like he had caused my birth defects. He had told my mother that every time he looked at me, he felt that it was his responsibility, he had caused this to me. And that's a major problem in the United States, trying to work through the Agent Orange issue, is that the veterans feel extreme guilt.
The man that my mom knew from the time she was four did not come home from Vietnam. He's still wandering around in the jungle somewhere. He came home a very angry man, very sad man.
My dad was suffering more and more from his PTSD. He was having other health issues and he was getting weak and he couldn't do the things that he could do before, and his health was just going downhill.